More people coming. Welcome to the sessional research event this evening here at Staple Inn. I'd like to welcome everybody, particularly personal guests of members, and I'd just like to mention a couple of housekeeping issues before we start with the real purpose of tonight's meeting. First of all, the fire procedure. The fire alarm for this building is a continuous ringing alarm. Should this go off during the meeting, please make your way calmly and efficiently to the assembly point, which is outside the Melton Mowbray Public House. So you exit through the archway and turn right. Okay. If you're wishing to claim CPD for this meeting, please sign the forms that are out there. They're just for auditing purposes only. So the Institute staff no longer record CPD for people. You need to record your own CPD online. And finally, can I ask you to turn off your mobile phones and BlackBerries as they interfere with the sound system? It's not sufficient to mute them. You need to put it onto flight mode or turn it off, which I have done with my BlackBerry, my phone, and my iPad now. So it took some time. But if you leave it switched on, it talks to its base, and it will interfere with our sound equipment. Okay, the first thing before we start to discuss the paper tonight is I have the great pleasure of presenting a prize to Emma Lathwaite, who's won a prize for CT8, which is financial economics. So it says on her certificate she was judged the best performing student in financial economics in the September 2010 examination diet. I'll come round, Emma, and present your prize. Well done, Emma. So we're now going to turn to the presentation of the IFRS Working Party paper, Insurance Accounting, A New Era. This is a work by quite a large group of people, Chris Barnard, Edward Conway, Cameron Farugi, who chaired the working group, Irina Kendix, Jeremy Straker, Raymond Bennett, Steve Caulfield, James Harrison, Marilyn Lenari-Boisclair, Darren Clay, Anthony Coughlin, Gary Hibbert, and Chris O'Brien. For the next 25 to 30 minutes, Cameron and Anthony are going to present an overview of the paper. And we're then going to seek comments from the floor. We're expecting and hoping for a fair number of comments today, so I will ask for a show of hands at the start, but we may restrict comments to 3 or 4 minutes. So have a think while they're presenting about the points you want to make. I'll introduce Cameron. Cameron is a senior consultant with Towers Watson in London and has been with the firm and its predecessor, Tillinghast Towers Perrin, for over 13 years. For the last 8 years, Cameron has held a number of financial reporting responsibilities in his firm, and he was appointed Global Life Financial and Regulatory Reporting Leader from the start of this year. In the last decade, Cameron has taken an active role in helping companies, industry bodies, and various actuarial professions develop their thinking on financial reporting, measurement and management, authoring many papers and presentations on the subject. And as I mentioned, Cameron has chaired this IFRS working party, which produced the paper today. So I'll hand over to Cameron, and then I'll introduce Anthony. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. I'd like to start by thanking a number of individuals. Thank you to the staff at the IASB working on the insurance contracts project. The publication of the insurance contracts exposure draft on the 30th of July 2010 was a significant achievement and has really helped engage the global insurance industry. The staff have shown the ability to listen to well thought through industry points of view and incorporate these in the recommendations to the board. Thank you to the reviewers of our paper who provided helpful comments on an earlier draft. Derek Wright, our UK representative at the International Actuarial Association, or IAA, the Insurance Accounting Subcommittee, he also helped draft the IAA response to the IASB. Peter Wright and Nick Dexter, two members of our LifePEC, who have taken such an active role in keeping our members informed of accounting developments with a series of notes posted on the actuaries.org.uk website. And these three plus Nigel Masters were all actively involved in the drafting of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries official response to the IASB, and we have quoted from several parts of the Institute and Faculty's response in our paper. And finally, thank you to all 13 members of the working party named on this slide. Developing the paper was very much a team effort, with everyone contributing at a time when we were all busy with our day jobs. And I'm delighted that 10 of the working party are here today. The rest of this presentation will cover an overview of the paper for those of you who have not yet had a chance to read. The paper is on the actuaries.org.uk website, and the link can be found on this slide. So what will we cover? In a moment, Anthony will summarise where we are today with international financial reporting standards and the main IASB proposals affecting insurance companies. He will then consider the implications, focusing on UK life insurers, but you will see that many of the issues go wider, extending to companies from all countries around the world and to non-life insurers. Now, just to note, the paper summarised the contents of the exposure draft published last July and took account of subsequent developments up to the end of January this year, including a number of the comments responses that were received by the 30th of November. But in certain areas, there have been significant developments in just the last month or two, with new tentative decisions by the IASB as they digest the comments letters. And Anthony will be updating us on these latest developments throughout his presentation. And at the end, I will briefly summarise our working party's conclusions and consider a possible future role for supplementary reporting. Back to Catherine and Anthony.
So Anthony is an associate director in the actuarial insurance practice of PwC. He has over a decade of experience in the life insurance industry and has spent the last 4 years providing technical support to the European Insurance CFO Forum across Solvency II, IFRS and embedded value. So I'll hand over to Anthony. Thank you.
Many thanks, Cameron and Catherine. Oh, that's it down here, is it? Ah, yes. So we're going to first consider the existing IFRS framework. The simplified diagram here illustrates the balance sheet for an insurer together with some of the most relevant IFRS accounting standards that are currently effective. On the asset side of the balance sheet, IAS 39 is currently the key standard. Financial assets are classified into a variety of categories, and the classification determines how the assets are measured, fair value or amortised cost, and how changes in measurement are reflected in the financial statements, for example, through P&L or through equity on the balance sheet. For many UK-based insurers, most financial assets are at fair value, with all changes in measurement reflected through the P&L. Moving to the contract liabilities, IFRS 4 represented the culmination of phase one of the IASB's insurance contracts project. It applies to those contracts which transfer significant insurance risk or contracts with a discretionary participation feature whether they transfer significant insurance risk or not. Consequently, IFRS 4 is applicable to most UK with-profits business. IFRS 4 permitted the continuation of many existing accounting practices, hence there is substantial variation across the world, and one of the drivers for the Phase 2 project. For UK-based life insurers, excluding bank assurers, the measurement model can be summarised in sort of two components. For non-profit business, the FSA regulatory regime is followed, removing contingency reserves and setting up a DAC asset to reduce new business strain. For with-profit funds, the FSA realistic regime is currently followed, removing shareholder transfers, holding a VIF asset for non-profit business within that fund, and setting up an unallocated divisible surplus liability for funds whose allocation between policyholders and shareholders has not yet been determined. For contracts that do not meet the criteria for IFRS 4, then IAS 39 and IAS 18 are relevant. For example, for UK unit-linked investment contracts, these are separated into two components. A financial liability and IAS 39 measured at fair value with a deposit floor, which is typically the bid value of units. An investment management services component and IAS 18 where acquisition costs and front-end fees are deferred and recognised as services are provided. Only acquisition costs incremental at the contract level are deferrable. So the three key standards, we've given a brief summary there, so IFRS 4, IAS 39 and IAS 18 are all currently undergoing major review, which we'll now consider. So moving to the proposed future IFRS. So the insurance contracts exposure draft is proposed to replace IFRS 4, and we'll come onto the ED in a moment. IFRS 9 will replace IAS 39 and will impact the classification and measurement of financial assets and liabilities on the balance sheet. Now, there's a lot in this new standard, but notably at a very high level, the measurement of financial assets is simplified to either fair value or amortised cost, and the deposit floor remains for investment contracts. The revenue recognition exposure draft is proposed to replace IAS 18 and will impact investment contracts for UK life insurers. Most notably, it is proposed acquisition costs will no longer be eligible for deferral. This would significantly increase new business strain from writing such contracts. Recent IAS board meetings, and in particular on the 2nd of February, have started to reconsider this proposal, considering comments received during the exposure period. In addition, there is a new standard being developed which will define how to determine the fair value of financial assets and liabilities, and so will impact the measurement of insurers' assets and investment contract liabilities. And there are two notable points here. The core principle for fair value, which is the price that would be received to sell an asset or transfer a liability in an orderly transaction between market participants at the measurement date. And in addition, the fair value of a liability should reflect the effect of non-performance risk. And we will return to those two points later. We now focus the remainder of the presentation on the insurance contracts exposure draft as published in summer 2010, which is the primary topic of our working party paper. So a single measurement model for all insurance contracts is proposed, consisting of the following components. Firstly, the discounted probability weighted estimate of fulfilment cash flows. The concept of probability weighted means that stochastic techniques may be required to capture material asymmetries, perhaps similar to the current or expected requirements of Solvency II and the FSA realistic regime for with-profit funds currently. Current and entity-specific assumptions are used for non-market variables, and importantly, unlike investment contracts, there is no deposit floor. The discount rates are to be consistent with observable market prices for instruments with cash flows whose characteristics reflect the liability, and there is explicit reference to including an illiquidity premium. Secondly, there is an explicit risk adjustment defined to be the maximum amount the insurer would rationally pay to be relieved of the risk that the ultimate fulfilment cash flows exceed those expected. The exposure draft permits only three measurement techniques: a cost of capital approach, similar to Solvency II, a confidence interval, and a conditional tail expectation. The risk adjustment is calculated at the portfolio level and so excludes the effect of diversification benefit between portfolios. And finally, there is the residual margin, which importantly is separate from the risk adjustment. The residual margin is set to eliminate an accounting gain on inception of an insurance contract. A negative residual margin is not permitted, so any losses on day one of the contract are immediately recognised. The residual margin is determined at the cohort level, which is within a portfolio by similar date of inception and similar period of coverage. Residual margin is then earned over the coverage period with no subsequent remeasurement. So all changes in experience from day two onwards go directly through to profit or loss. In other words, there's no use of the residual margin as a shock absorber. We know that for short duration contracts, that is where the coverage period is approximately 1 year or less, the exposure draft mandates a UPR approach for the pre-claims liability, while post-claims liabilities follow this building block approach. We're now going to move from the mechanics of the building blocks to review the proposed measurement model. Many existing insurance accounting models have elements of both a deferral and matching and an economic value approach. The deferral and matching approach allocates revenue and expenses in accordance with the provision of risk coverage or services, and is more focused on the income statement as a general rule. An economic value approach measures the value generation to shareholders arising from the sale of contracts, and is more on balance, more focused on the balance sheet. The fulfilment value model of the exposure draft is a hybrid between these two approaches, as illustrated by the three bullets that we have up on the slide. As it is a hybrid model, care will be required by users to interpret the results. The most common concern expressed on the exposure draft is that its adoption would lead to unrepresentative short-term fluctuations or volatility in reported IFRS profits, which does not reflect the fundamentals of long-term insurance business. Volatility can broadly be considered as a mix of accounting and economic mismatches. Accounting mismatches can arise from different asset and liability measurement approaches under IFRS. Economic mismatches are perhaps truer mismatches between assets and liabilities, reflecting risks taken by the insurer, which could be addressed by additional disclosure to explain them or by reducing those mismatches in practice. However, the dividing line between these two types of mismatches is often not clear-cut. A number of potential approaches have been put forward by the industry to mitigate some of the observed volatility in the exposure draft. We put four examples up here. The first one is subsequent remeasurement of the residual margin for non-economic assumptions. And clearly this would reduce volatility to the extent that the residual margin exists. And there are accounting precedents for such a model, in particular in Australia. A cost option, which would permit a locked-in discount rate for certain defined liabilities. This locked-in discount rate could be set at inception, and for consistency, you would have your backing assets on sort of an amortised cost valuation. Thirdly, there is a possible use of presentation, in particular using other comprehensive income, or OCI, on the balance sheet, rather than taking all changes in the contract liability through to net income. This approach would remove the volatility from certain key performance indicators. And finally, there is a discount rate. The exposure draft was interpreted by many observers as permitting only a bottom-up assessment, that is a risk-free rate plus an illiquidity premium. However, a top-down approach based on a replicating portfolio of assets, allowing for expected credit default risk and potentially a credit risk premium, could reduce some of the mismatches between assets and liabilities. All these four approaches have been recently discussed in ISB meetings, with only the cost option at this stage being tentatively rejected. Our working party paper also discusses four further mismatches. Firstly, as noted earlier, the fair value measurement exposure draft has a core principle that market prices need to form an orderly transaction. The insurance contract ED requires calibration to observable market prices, but does not mention the concept of an orderly transaction. Therefore, there would appear to be the potential for an accounting mismatch between insurance assets and liabilities in certain circumstances. This could be resolved by aligning the two proposals. Secondly, the exposure draft does not permit an insurance contract liability to reflect own credit risk, while full allowance is possible in the measurement of the backing assets at fair value and the reinsurance assets. This is a particularly challenging subject, and both points of view are put forward in section 5 of our paper. We note that some respondents to the exposure draft raises as a subject for further work. Our paper does recognise it is debatable whether this is an accounting or economic mismatch. Thirdly, in extreme market conditions, when the illiquidity premium is large, the impact on the discount rate and the measurement of liabilities will be significant. Insurers who do not own illiquid assets may be forced to recognise that accounting benefit without being able to capture the illiquidity premium in practice. This is an issue that forced a number of pension schemes to show a much reduced deficit or even a surplus in 2008, which appears a slightly odd accounting result in the midst of a financial crisis. It is debatable whether this is an accounting or economic mismatch. And finally, there remains potential inconsistencies between the IAS 12 approach to measure deferred tax assets and the ED approach to contract liabilities. For example, there is no discounting permitted in IAS 12, and the historic issues in the context of UK unit-linked business remain as noted in our profession's response to the exposure draft. Ooh, not quite yet. Moving to the risk adjustment, the core principle described earlier appears to imply an exit value rather than a fulfilment value concept. The ISB appears to have accepted this point and has tentatively revised the principle as noted on this slide. In addition, excluding the effect of diversification between portfolios is not consistent with how such business is valued and managed, and is at a lower level than was permitted in Quiz 5. Moving to the residual margin, the low level of granularity increases the likelihood and potential level of day one losses. In addition, the complexity is significantly increased, as all other components of the contract liability, most notably the risk adjustment, will need to be measured at that level of granularity. The residual margin is earned over the insurance coverage period, either on the basis of the passage of time or, if significantly different, the expected timing of incurred claims and benefits. This amortisation pattern has a potential to be significantly different to the provision of service and other unintended consequences as considered in our paper. We're now going to move from a high-level review of the model to consider a number of other issues for UK life insurers. So as a sneak preview earlier on, the timeline, and in particular the interactions between IFRS and Solvency II. So the slide contains the current known timeline over the next 4 years. As you can see, 2011 is a crucial year with the finalisation of various IFRS standards, and it will be important that the effective date of all these standards are synchronised to avoid the requirement for multiple transitions and restatements. And the ISB is currently undertaking a project on this matter. The ISB staff recently provided a tentative recommendation to the board that the date of mandatory adoption of the insurance contract standard should not be before 1 January 2015. With the publication by the European Commission of the draft Omnibus II directive setting the effective date of Solvency II to be 1 January 2013, it is therefore highly likely that Solvency II will be effective before a new insurance contract standard. This will present a range of practical challenges and considerations for insurers during the interim period. Most notably, as IFRS 4, as we mentioned at the start, is often based on FSA return valuation, which will be redundant in the Solvency II world. There would appear to be a number of options for insurers during that interim period. You could maintain the current approach, which would involve parallel running two sets of models. You could maybe adopt Solvency II, adjusted or unadjusted under IFRS 4. Alternatively, you may be permitted to early adopt the new insurance contract standard, be that in the standard itself or under IFRS 4 as an improvement to the existing accounting policy. In addition, and not on this slide, but we shouldn't forget, the changes by HMRC to the taxation regime during the interim period and thereon would be another consideration for insurers. Moving back to technical matters, and in particular in the next two slides, we do cover quite a few issues that we're not going to be able to do full justice to this evening. Firstly, the arrangements and the points of transition to the new insurance standard. The contract liability is defined to be the best estimate plus the risk adjustment without a residual margin. The change from the existing IFRS contract liability, net of intangibles, is released to shareholder equity. Consequently, the amount will never be recognised in the income statement, and the loss of these future profits could be substantial. There has been much industry comment on the transitional arrangements, and the ISB has indicated that this aspect of the exposure draft is likely to change. And I think our working party welcomes this indication. The most common suggestion during the comment period was to permit a full retrospective application, perhaps on a best efforts basis. Moving to the cash flows, in the exposure draft, the following expenses are excluded from the cash flows used to determine the liability: acquisition costs that are not incremental at the contract level, and general overheads. Incremental acquisition costs are included in the initial contract liability assessment, and such contracts act to reduce the initial residual margin and can be thought of as an implicit DAC asset, there to reduce new business strain. In recent ISB meetings, it's been proposed that only acquisition costs that are incremental at the portfolio level should be excluded. Sorry, that are not incremental at the portfolio level. This will be a change to the exposure draft, which was at the contract level, and will move more closer, or closer still, to UK practice under IFRS 4. And our working party welcomes this development. Moving to unbundling. An insurance contract is required to be unbundled into different components where there are components of the contract that are not closely related to the insurance coverage. So it's a bit of a mouthful. Three examples are provided in the ED. Those unbundled components are then valued under the relevant IFRS standard, typically revenue or financial instruments. There are three issues we put down here to note. Firstly, the term closely related is not defined and so is open to potential interpretation. For example, does the principle of closely related take precedence over the three examples? The scope of unbundling is fundamental as it impacts the measurement of the contract liabilities and the consequent recognition of profit. In particular, one only has to consider an IFRS 9 or IAS 39 valuation under amortised cost compared to this model. In addition, there are practical challenges from unbundling, for example, allocating charges and expenses when unbundling a unit balance. Moving to contract boundaries, in the measurement model, cash flows are only included to the extent they are within the boundary of the contract. In the exposure draft, the contract boundary was triggered by a pricing reassessment at the policyholder level. This was generally preferred to the Quiz 5 definition, where the assessment was interpreted to be at the portfolio level. In recent ISB meetings, the contract boundary definition has been reconsidered, reflecting comments from health insurers to the exposure draft, and in particular, the meeting only a week or so ago, which discussed a contract renewal definition. Moving to participating business, I mean, clearly there are a wide range of impacts for participating with profit contracts from the exposure draft, but there's one in particular we would like to draw out. And this in particular relates to paragraph B61J, which makes reference to cash flows in respect of future policyholders being included in the contract liability, though this is contradicted in a number of other places. If the estate, as a consequence of B61J, is to be treated as a liability, then this would impact the mutual business model as it is a main source of capital. More generally, further clarification on the treatment of surplus assets in the with-profit fund is required to avoid inconsistencies across the industry. finally, we come to presentation and disclosure. We're not going to be able to do this important section of the exposure to justice due to time constraints, but we would like to draw three remarks to your attention. Firstly, the income statement is proposed to be presented using a summarised margins analysis rather than the traditional revenue account, so there'll be no volume information. The approach is more akin to an embedded value earnings analysis. However, the minimum standard appears to focus more on the liability side of the balance sheet rather than capturing the full interactions between assets and liabilities. Secondly, there is a requirement to have a reconciliation between opening and closing contract liabilities. The minimum standard for this reconciliation appears to mix two distinct approaches to such an analysis: an analysis by source of surplus and analysis by source of cash flow. In addition, as observed earlier, the risk adjustment can be determined through one of three permitted techniques. To aid comparability, there is a requirement to disclose the confidence level to which the risk adjustment corresponds. For European insurers, who are likely to be following a cost of capital approach through Solvency II, this is likely to result in significant additional work, and the benefit is questionable given the theoretical weaknesses in the confidence level method. And as a final point, moving from technical to commercial implications, we consider the impact on IFRS new business earnings. Our working party paper provides illustrative pre-tax projected earnings for existing and proposed IFRS for two products: an immediate annuity, as shown here, and a term assurance. A simple profit test model was used. For the immediate annuity, we observe there is no day one profit due to the residual margin, and there is a possibility for a day one loss given potential differences between the exposure draft discount rate and the pricing discount rate. Non-incremental acquisition costs are expensed at inception, and profit is deferred and released with the residual margin over the life of the contract. And overall, it is only the timing of profit recognition that is altered. I now pass you back to Cameron to consider the collective conclusions of our working party and the potential future role for supplementary reporting. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Anthony. So what are our conclusions of the IASB's developments? The development of a single insurance liability accounting standard and measurement model applicable globally is a major achievement. Even the FASB are on board, with a similar model being proposed to replace US GAAP. We welcome that the measurement model includes expected cash flows with assumptions consistent with current market prices and up-to-date entity-specific best estimates. We note that the exposure draft proposals, combined with other IASB developments, provide a framework that can lead to far fewer accounting mismatches than can be observed today. But there are a number of issues. The hybrid nature of the exposure draft measurement model will be challenging for users to understand. Significant volatility may arise. Now, there is nothing wrong with measuring and understanding economic volatility. The insurance industry is about taking risk, and with taking risk, you get economic volatility. But there are a number of aspects of the exposure draft and wider IFRS developments where we will end up with volatility, and it will not be clear whether this volatility is economic or accounting related. There is also a debate to be had about whether the primary account P&L is the right place to show all the economic volatility. And finally, while we could support the principle of having a risk adjustment, we do not support the specific risk adjustment principle as put forward by the exposure draft. We describe a number of issues in the paper, and to be fair, the IASB is addressing several of them with their latest proposals in this area. So where does this leave us in communicating with investors? Chapter 8 of the paper recognises the great work insurance companies have been doing in recent years, better explaining the sources of their IFRS earnings, allowing users to consider how earnings may arise in the future, providing increased focus on the amount and timing of expected cash flows using existing embedded value models, This allows companies to communicate wider metrics, such as implied discount rates, internal rates of return, and payback periods. Both IFRS and Solvency II proposals will improve existing practices and disclosures, but a number of items which provide useful insight into aspects of an insurance company's business are missing from both IFRS and Solvency II proposed disclosures. Our working party conclusion is clear. There will be an important role for supplementary reporting in the future. And that ends our overview of the paper, and we now look forward to hearing what you think. Thank you very much.
I'd like to invite Richard McVeigh to open the discussion now.
Thank you, Catherine. Everybody hear me okay? As some of you know, I'm not a real actuary. I'm actually a chartered accountant, but I do have the honour of being an honorary fellow of your profession. And it's a particular honour to have been invited to open this evening's discussion. This paper kept me absorbed for most of my five-hour train ride back to Aberystwyth last week. And I congratulate Cameron and his 12 colleagues, now to be christened the Baker's Dozen Working Party, on what is indeed a very impressive survey and analysis of the IASB's insurance exposure drafts, together with the proposed changes to related accounting standards and as well of the developments in Solvency II and in tax and in embedded value reporting. The last time I gave a formal address here at Staple Inn was at the inauguration of the Equitable's archive, which contains William Morgan's first valuation in 1776, when he determined the distributable surplus by a reckoning of the difference between the liabilities, the present value of the sums assured, and the assets, the present value of future premiums, together with the investments. But it was not until nearly a century later that the 1870 Life Assurance Companies Act accepted that such actuarial valuations were the only way to produce meaningful life company accounts. Before then, they'd been described in one House of Commons debate as mere puffs. So inaugurating a new era in life insurance accounting has always been a long process. And actuaries have often had to patiently go over basic arguments to non-actuarial sceptics. The IASB's predecessor, the International Accounting Standards Committee, started this current review in 1997. And since then, your profession has been faced with repeated exposure of ever-changing proposals. As the paper discusses in section 5.3, before the latest exposure draft, the IASB's 2007 discussion paper had proposed a very different approach to that now put forward, where the proposed current exit value for life insurance liabilities appeared indistinguishable from fair value, now that fair value is defined, as we saw, as an exit price to transfer a liability. This new proposal in the exposure draft is much closer to the approach that's now been adopted by both FASB and IASB in their exposure draft on revenue recognition, which has retained a more traditional deferral and spreading of the initial contract consideration and matching with costs, as the FASB and IASB board members were uncomfortable with the day one profits on contract inception that would arise if fair value were adopted. And the paper here in section 5 clearly discusses how the approach now proposed to life insurance liability measurement seems to fall between the two stools of a wholly deferral and matching approach and an economic value approach and suggests alternative ways to resolve this, which the boards are thinking about. But because of the focus just on the liabilities, the risk of accounting mismatch with investment valuation still seems high. Moreover, while noting that there's been an increased emphasis in the recent years of great financial uncertainty on the need for triangulation of embedded value results with IFRS results and cash flow results, the paper in Section 8 does see a continuing role for the supplementary embedded value information. And here it's interesting to note the results of some very recent international empirical research by George Serafim at Harvard, which finds that firms that adopt EV reporting exhibit a decline in information asymmetry measured via bid-ask spreads and via trading volumes. And this improvement in informativeness increases as embedded value reporting itself has evolved through European embedded value and market-consistent embedded value to address methodological deficiencies and permit more comparability across firms. This decrease in information asymmetry is contingent on a number of factors, including some audit certification, and is larger for firms that commit to providing embedded value reports, for example, through CFO forum membership. And there are other country differences which may help explain the differential adoption of embedded value disclosures. Embedded value reporting is also associated with what in accounting research is called value relevance. In other words, the embedded value results are more closely correlated with stock market returns than are GAAP, accounting GAAP profits and losses. So why is there a continuing lack of enthusiasm amongst US insurers for giving these disclosures, despite evidence that they are using embedded value internally for performance measurement and compensation arrangements? It may be that US GAAP has addressed insurance directly for much longer and mitigated the severity of solvency-based reporting by spreading deferred acquisition costs and provides disclosure on roll forward of reserves. But it may have more to do with the situation that most US corporations are nowadays well protected against hostile takeovers. But it does remain an intriguing question why in Europe and elsewhere in the world the embedded values seem to be regarded as very important, but apparently not in the US, at least for public disclosure. And perhaps correspondingly, the FASB's proposals that came out shortly after the ISB's exposure draft do have a different treatment for the residual margin. And if that difference is not resolved, then there will still be a difference between the two boards' proposals and, well, we won't have harmony in a new era. Finally, like the authors, I share concerns about the proposed changes in presentation and the loss of traditional premiums, less claims type revenue accounts. I suspect this is maybe a largely unnecessary hangover from the previous exposure draft when the proposed basis for liability measurement was very different. My personal concern with the welter of regulatory requirements from different sources, which is set out clearly in the paper and that somehow have to be reconciled, is that box ticking purely for external requirements seems unlikely to produce the most useful information. Naively, perhaps, based on my own auditing experiences of long ago, and in particular the audit of those old DTI returns that insurers had to file, my behavioural premise is that information that is useful for and used by managers is more likely to be reliable than information that is only produced to satisfy external reporting requirements. And the role of embedded value in management must be one of the main arguments for regarding it as particularly useful and informative. And I'm remembering here Jeremy Goford's classic paper on the control cycle back in 1985. So there's clearly much to discuss in this excellent paper, and I'm sure that now I make way for the real actuaries, the comments will gain sharply in focus. I'm only glad to hear that the IASB and FASB are still listening. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. The discussion is now open to the floor. Before I start calling on people, could I have a show of hands from people who are interested in making a comment, please? Okay, well, hopefully you'll be really controversial and then more people will speak. So I'll try and restrict people to 3 or 4 minutes. To help the debate develop and flow, if you have a number of points to make, could you make the first one or two? And I say keep your comments short, and then we can also come back to you later on if you have more points to make. If you could state your name clearly before making your contribution, and don't let the fact that the meeting is being recorded deter you from contributing, or the fact that it will be on the internet for eternity. There are roving microphones around the room, or you can come and use the podium at the front. It's completely up to you. And if you have any notes, if you could hand them in at the end for the transcript for the British Actuarial Journal. Okay, so I have four guys at the front, so I'll start with John Jenkins, because you collared me in the tea room. So you can go first.
Thank you. My name is John Jenkins. I'd like to thank the Working Party and the authors for a very useful and timely paper. The new standard is, in my view, developing along sensible lines, although clearly there are many areas of uncertainty. I'm quite happy with the principles-based approach. I see this as being comparable to, for example, the principles and the level of detail set out within the MCV guidelines or within the current FSA realistic balance sheet rules. We are currently seeing elsewhere difficulties which one can get into if one seeks to prescribe the full details of a market-based valuation approach. I am, of course, referring to the various Solvency II papers and the Quiz 5 specifications, which are extremely voluminous, impossible to digest, and often contain inconsistencies, and I wouldn't advocate that approach for this. For a profit reporting standard, I think we have to accept that no profit is recognised on inception. Whilst this seems an unnecessary restriction from a pure actuarial point of view, I do think we have to accept that it does need to be the case for an international profit reporting standard. The Australians recognised this when they introduced their margin on services methodology several years ago, and both their industry and their actuarial profession is very similar to ours. The US GAAP approach also eliminates profit on inception and recognises it over the policy term. I do have an issue with the exposure draft as currently drafted in terms of the highly restricted level of margin, which can be recognised at outset to meet what companies themselves reasonably class as acquisition costs. However, I understand that since the exposure draft was published, things have moved on positively, and the current ISB thinking is, I understand, to allow a more sensible definition of acquisition costs, and hence the margin which can be released on inception to match those costs. I also understand that there are signs of positive development since the exposure draft was published in the area of unlocking, or the shock absorber, as was referred to earlier, in the residual margin to counter changes in non-financial best estimate assumptions. This again seems sensible to me. One aspect which clearly does need to be addressed is that of the existing business. It clearly does not make sense to have no emerging residual margin here, and some practical approach is needed, such as that which took place in Australia when the MOS method was introduced in order to introduce a margin to emerge on existing businesses. I do think that actuaries and accountants will need to work together, even more closely than hitherto, in order to properly understand each other and to cope with the various terminologies being used. On acquisition expenses, I personally find some of the terminology very confusing, such as the use of the expression in the cash flows when referring to acquisition costs. To me, cash flows are things that happen in the future, and acquisition costs are something that happened in the past. I'm sure that many accountants have similar issues, but in reverse with our own actuarial terminology. Coming back to the issue of principles-based approach versus rules, the principles-based approach will require further guidance, if only informal guidance, as well as more description and codification of the different approaches which can be followed. There is much scope for the actuarial profession and for actuaries working within life companies and professional services firms to provide this going forwards. Thank you very much.
Alistair Black, Towers Watson. I'd like to thank the Working Party for their presentation tonight and for producing a thorough and helpful review of future financial reporting. Anthony showed us a slide of the IFRS and Solvency II timelines, and I'd like to comment on what some of the differences between IFRS 2 and Solvency II mean in practical terms for system development and the preparation work needed over the next few years. Starting off with the simplest, essentially parameter differences. For example, the risk-free rate is prescribed in Solvency II, whereas in IFRS, we will need to follow the principle that the discount rate should be consistent with the nature of the liabilities. If insurers choose to use a different discount rate, this should just be a simple parameter change in the models, and this will just involve a new run on existing systems on an IFRS basis. Now, methodology differences present potentially far harder issues. IFRS Phase 2 being genuinely principles-based gives more flexibility on the calculation of, for example, the risk adjustment than on the related risk margin in Solvency II. Even those planning to use internal models may wish to use a separate approach for IFRS Phase 2, where the guidance for the calculation will be just a few paragraphs, not the few thousand pages of Level 2 and Level 3 rules. Contract boundaries may or may not end up in the same place in the two standards, so there will need to be flexibility as to which cash flows are included in the liability models. On the asset side, the IESB's fair value project, as discussed, will give a slightly different meaning to fair value in stressed markets compared to Solvency II, where deviation from strict market values is currently harder to justify. This is something to prepare for now, so that in the next financial crisis, where transactions are not orderly, we already have a system in place to allow us to use something other than market values for IFRS. The residual margin presents an entirely new methodology problem, not to mention a communication problem. Insurers will need to determine the residual margin in the year of sale, keep track of its runoff over time. Systems will need to identify policies within a portfolio by those with similar start dates and similar coverage periods, and then calculate the residual margin using the premium received and direct expenses for those policies. This may be possible through careful choice of model points, but we should be aware that our current model point choices may need refining. Transitional arrangements could also throw up some tricky modelling challenges. Even once we're able to calculate results on both these bases, we will then need to report and explain them. So there'll be similar challenges for reporting templates and presentation in the accounts, plus a clear need for reconciliation. To conclude, there are a large number of modelling and system implications of the introduction of IFRS Phase 2. We are all currently sprinting to keep up with the deadlines and shifting requirements of Solvency II. However, it is vital that we plan now for IFRS. Our Solvency II plans need to consider IFRS requirements. Even if there is no spare capacity to put in IFRS functionality, as an absolute minimum, the system architecture needs to have the flexibility to easily add IFRS functionality later. Otherwise, much of the large investment in Solvency II modelling will need to be repeated. And our new, sleek, efficient, well-documented Solvency II systems may need to have messy coding changes and manual end-piece adjustments. This will lead to inefficient use of time, money, and resources, and ultimately, systems that are hard to use and output that is hard to interpret. Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Paul Whitlock. Life insurers continue to struggle to engage with investors, due in no small part to the industry's failure to communicate its dividend-paying capability. The industry has struggled with accounting, regulatory, and embedded value metrics that many argue give an inconsistent and confusing picture. So will this be resolved with Phase 2 of the IASB's insurance contracts project? Unfortunately not. The IASB's exposure draft puts forward as has been discussed, a hybrid measurement model combining elements of both a deferral and matching approach and an economic value approach, which will make the results difficult to interpret. This hybrid approach will provide neither an allocation of revenue and expenses to future periods in accordance with the provision of risk coverage or services, nor a measure of value generation to shareholders. The accounting results are therefore unlikely to be sufficient to communicate the underlying performance of life insurers to investors. Instead, what is required is a balanced scorecard of performance metrics. A company's dividend-paying capability is significantly driven by its capital position, as demonstrated in its regulatory returns. Therefore, the movement in the regulatory surplus and an indication of how it will develop are critical information. Preparing this information requires an understanding of how capital recycles between the releases from the in-force book and the capital requirements of new business. However, as we're all aware, the movement in regulatory surplus is not a good measure of life company performance and profitability. And as the authors note in Appendix A of the paper, Solvency II will not change this, as the focus of Solvency II is to demonstrate solvency to regulators and not to provide a measure of equity and performance over time to investors. There therefore remains a key role for supplementary reporting, including a realistic measure of the economic value that represents the realistic value today of future earnings available for distribution to shareholders. Supplementary reporting should also provide a realistic measure of the value added by writing new business, including additional simple new business metrics such as the internal rate of return and capital payback periods. These are familiar to investors. Projections of free cash flows can be used to demonstrate the dividend-paying capabilities of insurers and should also be included. A balanced scorecard should include the IFRS and Solvency II results, but also these supplementary results, as well as the sensitivity of all of the results to changes in circumstances. These sensitivities can be used by management to better understand the risks in the business. Management can then articulate and manage to its risk appetite expressed in terms of these metrics. Communicating this will help investors better understand the nature of their investment. Only if we can get the presentation and communication of such a balanced scorecard right will we start to see the life industry re-engaging with its investors. Thank you.
John Ryan. Basically, coming this from a totally different angle, I used to be an investment analyst for a significant part of my career, and also I'm investor in Sure Shares, and therefore, as an investor and as an investment analyst, the one thing I wanted to know was information I can use and make my own judgments for. The one thing I do not want is anything that has subjective judgments on it. Now, I appreciate that subjective judgments are put into these things, but the important thing is that all the disclosure and the assumptions are that at least an outsider can make approximate adjustments to what's actually going on. And so a lot of the precise definitions as a user of accounts, as an outside user of accounts, as opposed to internal management, is totally different. And I think that's one thing that hasn't come through with any of these, the various accountancy boards and its successes in doing that, is that as an investor, I frankly don't trust accountants. I made enough money in professional indemnity claims and expert witness and claims reserving on those to know that there were lots of problems there. So the question of whether you should recognise profit recognised on an inception or not, which is one of the issues that's been discussed, the issue I want to know as a user of accounts is what has been done and how can I unwind that, even approximately, Not necessarily precisely, because that's always going back through. I concede that as a, you know, if I were to be a chief executive of a life company, I would want something a lot more precise and going along those lines with all those things spelt out, because I could then go and discuss and say, rework those numbers. As an investor, you can't. Same with the change in assumptions coming back through. An accountant say that needs to be recognised through in the profit and loss account. And I can see why that the arguments that's made, and it's made very perfect sense. I want to be able to quantify that as an outsider. And very often those numbers are not come back through. It doesn't come out and through clear in those assumptions. Because one change in those assumptions makes a mega difference. And boy, does that make a difference coming back through. And that gives you an indication of the ongoing likely estimate of the earnings per share. And I don't want somebody else's opinion of what the ongoing element of that is. I want to be able to form that myself. I think most outside investors want to do that. Okay, there are the smaller investors that rely on free markets and so on to do the analysis to deal that. But by and large, market prices are made by people either expert in these things or have access to expert advice, and that needs to become back through. Again, the principles approach, okay, great thing, needs to be spelt out very clearly and what any changes would actually might make. And it's the disclosure of those aspects and the disclosure of the other items that, in my view, is very, very much more important than the precise definition. We've had some slightly heated arguments. I'm sure there'll be some more later on over that. The same again with risk discount rates. Lots of very strong views, what's an appropriate risk discount rate. Different risk discount rates makes enormous differences to the various numbers. I don't care, as a user of accounts, what's actually used, so long as I can unwind, even approximately, what that can be. And I think that comes back through. There's been some comment also then, change it slightly, on this Solvency II versus the other accountancy approaches. Solvency II is there about solvency. And I assume, Madam Chairman, you know a fair amount about that, that you actually understand that that's about solvency. It's not about accounting standards. And what you want for solvency may well be can be very different. In some cases, they're the same. But they're different issues. This day and age, with computers and heaven knows what else, we can reproduce all these numbers very quickly. Let's not confuse ourselves with what we're going to do. I mean, you know, in my childhood, when I learnt the difference between a net premium and bonus reserve valuation, there was a distinction. We didn't have any problems with it. Let's not worry about it now trying to cut down doing these things when we've got all the tools and so on and things that we're having to employ an army of clerks to do that. So the point I'm trying to make is let's think a little bit about the users and particularly third-party users of the account. And a lot of this, I congratulate the authors. It's a very valuable paper, very interesting paper, very helpful paper. But a lot of the actual output of the accountants' body, let's think of the third-party users of what we're going to do, because the third-party users of these are what to do. If you're doing your own internal management accounts, you can do whatever you like, and you can do it that way, and a lot of that makes sense, but think of the third-party users, and let's have something that is objective, that a third party can, even if they haven't got all the information disclosed that they would ideally like, let's at least let them to make approximations to do that. I was able to do that 30 years ago. I'm sure we can do that. It shouldn't be impossible in the present age now. Thank you.
Any other people who would like to speak? I'll look up at the top as well to give people a chance to come down the stairs if you're interested. Okay. Tony.
Yeah, my name's Tony Silverman. These are unprepared comments. I work as an investment analyst following the insurance sector. I'd like to say it's an extremely welcome paper. It's a very good paper, and it's entirely appropriate that the Institute of Actuaries should be at least this involved in this topic. So it's extremely welcome. It is really just three points that I want to make. They're ones that I have made before, but I think they bear repetition on this occasion. In paragraph 5.2.4, that's where, as Anthony mentioned in the introduction, there's an attempt to categorise approaches to accounting between a deferral and matching and an economic approach. And the deferral and matching was presented as more focused on P&L and economic approach more focused on the balance sheet. That is absolutely correct. That is how that is what we've seen in the past. And that is where we are indeed. What I'd like to suggest is that what needs to be done is to have an economic, a truly economic approach to the P&L. And that is where some real thinking needs to be done. Because what is missing from, one of the things that are missing from life insurance company reporting at the moment is a profit number that people can meaningfully attach a PE multiple to. And I don't think we should be too sniffy about people wanting to attach PE multiples to profits. And so we need to think very carefully in general terms about how to do that. And actually, I think that's one of the reasons why the residual margin, which may seem deeply unactuarial, is actually a good thing because it helps in that direction. The second point that I want to make is it's to do with paragraph 5.2.9, where the downsides, if you like, of an economic approach are very briefly mentioned. And I think the direction that the paper is pointing is perhaps betrayed by the fact that it's so brief, when the embedded values are really got quite a bad name. And I'd like to suggest that one of the things that I'd add to that paragraph is that for most of the policies on the books of a life insurer, the profits that emerge from an embedded value in any one year have nothing to do with the premium that's charged. They are, in fact, I'd characterise them as the profits that you would have made if you had charged the economically correct premium as you now calculate it, which is almost never going to be the premium that you actually charged. And that is a fundamental drawback of embedded value. And indeed, it has to be reconciled with any economic approach that's ultimately taken. And the third and final point that I wanted to make was to do with paragraph 5.4.2, where there's beginnings of a discussion on own credit risk. And this is a very knotty problem. And I think it's one of the things that will give rise to most of the volatility. I think it needs to be clear that there's a pretty immediate reaction on the part of most investors that and analysts that we don't want own credit risk, however minimally. The initial reaction is that we don't want own credit risk affecting the profit number. Banks have it in and lots of people have it in various places. I can tell you that it's removed from any numbers that are used for PE multiples. And it's a bit of an irritation on that basis. And the point is that as shareholders, that shareholders are not interested in scenarios fundamentally where the company is going to default, because they're zeroed out in those scenarios anyway. So they're really only interested in what's happening in the other scenarios. It may be that own credit risk eventually is appropriate, but I think that will be intimately connected with the framework for bail-inable debt, if that should emerge, and that is what will determine what people will really do with that number. So those are just some brief comments, which I hope are helpful, on what I think is, as I say, an extremely welcome paper. Thank you.
Contributions. I've been particularly interested to hear the comments about how users of these accounts will find them. As personally, I think that insurance company accounting is a bit of a self-inflicted competitive disadvantage when the industry is trying to attract investment, as insurance company accounts have so many caveats and descriptions and notes that it's quite hard to look at them and understand what's going on and also how to compare them. So I'd be interested in people's views on whether this proposed standard, thank you, would help that.
Robert Mumford. From a third-party point of view, I think disclosure would be enhanced greatly if we included expected future cash flows on an aggregate, say, annual basis, and that way any arguments over, for instance, discount rates would be null and void because investors could just choose what discount rates they wanted to apply in addition to the maybe proposed ones in, say, the EV disclosure. And I think that would greatly enhance communication.
Okay. Any other comments? Would any of the other authors of the paper like to comment? No? Maybe you can think about that while Peter Wright speaks.
The name is Peter Wright. These are unscripted comments, but there are two areas that I'd like to make a few remarks on. One is the process used by the IASB to draft their standards. They use, it seems to me, a project-based approach, and there are separate projects on insurance accounting, financial instruments, and service contracts. And very little coordination is obvious amongst these three, even though insurance companies are big issuers of financial investment contracts, hinging on the exact interpretation of the definition of an insurance risk, there can be differences in accounting treatment, and I think unbundling, as proposed under the exposure draft would exacerbate this difference because different sections of the contract are more likely to be unbundled than under IFRS 4. Now, a good example of my concern is that we have an allowance for acquisition costs in the insurance standard. But under the service standard, as exposed, there was no capitalisation of acquisition costs permitted. So immediately a huge difference would have occurred between an accounting for an insurance contract and a very, very similar financial instrument. Now, I do understand that it is quite possible that the IASB may reconsider their views on service contracts, but it's not obvious that this is because of the problems caused by for insurance companies in having vast difference in accounting standard. So I would put in a plea for the ISB to have a sort of more holistic overview of their standard setting process. And I think EFRAG have asked for comments on how standards are produced. So I'm quite likely that this comment will be formally made to the ISB. The other point is the future of supplementary reporting. Previous speakers have been very keen that this should continue, and certainly if the only alternative accounting was the IFRS, I would agree with them. But if one looks at the differences between embedded market consistent embedded value and Solvency II, I think with the sole and big exception of with profits contracts, where there is a need to split any free estate between a policyholder element and a shareholder element using well understood burn through costs, etc. The differences between Solvency II and market consistent embedded value are quite small. And I think a number of companies would be very keen to reduce their need to look at three sets of accounts and only look at two. Speaking as a non-executive director, I think some of our non-actuary NEDs would eyes a bit glaze over when they have to look at all three in a very short space of time. There isn't time to adequately think about what's going on. And I would hope that under Solvency II, that will be the principal focus of even group reporting, subject to tweaking substantially the with-profits 90-10 element to bring out the shareholder value. Of course, I accept that Solvency II is not designed as a reporting standard, whereas what we want is something that produces reasonable profits and values of new business. So I'm not suggesting that the actual presentation won't change, but the actual sums on which it's based can be the same. And I think the industry will gain a great deal of credibility if it can make that happen, notwithstanding that the cost of capital might, as a second order, differ from the frictional cost that you might ideally like to have under an EEV. I think we ought to accept some less than pure result to get greater credibility. Thanks.
Speaker at the back.
Hello, Martin White. I came in late and I was listening in peace downstairs, but then it became clear that you were a bit short of speakers, so I thought I'd contribute
Martin,
something.
Could you speak up?
Oh, I'm sorry. Martin White. As the paper says, the ISB has been working to encourage consistency in accounting standards for many years. The insurance project, presenting as it does so very many difficult challenges, has been tackled later than most other projects. My area of expertise these days is non-life, as opposed to life, so there are some complications covered in the paper which don't concern me. I was a supporter of the IAS project from the beginning, the most important aspect for me being to raise the standard of reserving around the world. As time has passed, however, I have become increasingly concerned with the principles and motivations behind the entire project. I may now or not be in the mainstream, but the crux of my concern is prudence, or more precisely, the disappearance of prudence as a fundamental and driving feature. What's the purpose of accounts? One of the reasons I find thinking about accounting so difficult is that one set of numbers can be used, or is tried to be used, for so many different things, which of course is doomed to fail. My understanding of the UK Companies Act for any type of company is that prudence is required to protect the company from over-distribution, to ensure that the company remains a going concern after any dividends, and to protect creditors from the abuse of the limited liability put option. This principle completely overrides, in my view, what the accounting profession might wish the world to be. And if anyone is interested in exploring this further, they should read the evidence sessions from and the written evidence to the House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee inquiry into auditing. The problem in banking, which was the thing that prompted the House of Lords Committee, is arguably much starker than insurance. IASB was effectively used in UK banks in spite of its not conforming with the UK law. The accounting standard in respect of bad debt was not to look ahead properly, with the result that banks were signed off as a going concern and suddenly were not, with huge losses. Coming back to insurance, the imprudence principle keeps rearing its head. Own credit risk is a case in point, as Tony Silverman has already explained. As I get older, I become more and more interested in the impact of culture and institutional environment within an organisation and what it makes people do. A significant part of the industry's motivation appears to me to do with how the industry is perceived, and with a wish to see higher share prices. I think this is more to do with interest and share options than with the creation of long-term value for shareholders. That sounds like I'm ending on a negative note, but my remarks have been very hastily prepared. I believe that human nature needs to be taken account of, and technical aspects sometimes need to be put slightly to one side. Thank you.
Any other people wishing to make a comment? I've been wondering personally what the... Rob, thank you.
I'm Rob Seward from the UK FSA. Listening to the comments that have been raised so far, there's been a real emphasis on messages going back to the ISB about their proposals and perhaps areas where they need to refocus or reconsider. Personally, I'd just like to say I sort of support where the ISB have come out with their insurance contracts work. It's very much consistent with reporting in other areas, and I think consistency for insurance accounts with the accounts in other sectors is very important. And by focusing too much on the insurance side, we might perhaps lose that comparability. So that's perhaps a warning against deviating too far from the principles that are applied elsewhere. In addition, I'd also like to emphasise that I think once we have a standard in the middle of this year, the emphasis really does turn back upon preparers, accountants, and also actuaries to see how best those proposals can be implemented. The Working Party paper I found very informative and very interesting, but I would have been interested to see more views about where they think the actuarial profession can help drive forward improvements in the regime, and if that's an area that the Working Party members who are represented have some views, it'd be interesting to hear them now. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Peter Clark from the ISB staff. I'd like to congratulate the authors for a very well-written paper, which is going to provide us a lot of useful input over the next 2 or 3 months as we try and finalise this standard. I think the thing I've most appreciated from the discussion we've heard this evening is the focus on users and the need for clear information that users can understand and gain some insight into what insurance companies are doing. I'd like to pick up one aspect the last two or three of the last speakers have mentioned, which is the need for consistency. And that's something that's very clear to our heart, very dear to our hearts as well. I think it's not something we do perfectly at the moment, but I think we do it much more than people outside realize. But I think one thing you need to understand is that that actually works both ways. And a number of the things that you hate most about the ED, and that some of you hated even more about some of the previous proposals, were areas where the board was actually trying to be consistent with other areas. For example, the treatment of acquisition costs, the difference between revenue recognition and insurance, own credit risk, and there are a number of other areas. The deposit floor was mentioned a few times. The deposit floor is an area where if we were trying to be absolutely consistent, we would undoubtedly have a deposit floor in this standard. So I think consistency up to a point. We've taken quite a long time to get this point to this point, in fact, a very long time. And part of the need for that has been to try and understand where we need to be consistent and where we need to be legitimately different. And in discussing this issue over a number of years with the board, I think we've constantly had pushback from people saying, is this special pleading from insurance? If you want something different, justify why it's different. I think we need to bring insurance accounting into the mainstream so that mainstream investors can understand it, not just the specialists, some of the people in this room. So we need the right balance between consistency and things that are appropriate for insurance. But again, thank you to the Working Party. It was a very useful paper, and we look forward to the continued dialogue with you.
Rob's challenge to the actuarial profession about how we're going to take this forward, maybe? No? We'll just wait and see. have any particular issues you'd like to raise, Simon? Okay, do we have a speaker then? Erica, thanks.
Erica Nicholson. I didn't plan to say anything, so I don't have prepared notes, but I just wanted to respond to Rob Seward's challenge around what the things that we could do. One of the key concerns I have is around communication. To me, it's not so much important what the measurement standard is, and I congratulate the ISB on the work that they've done in developing the standards and the proposals as they have. But as a profession, we understand what underpins these calculations. And I think it's very important that we think about how these calculations and the changes in those and the volatility over time should be interpreted and understood by the users of the financial statements. Thank you.
Any? Oh, John?
About consistency across different industries, which I think is a very important point and a very interesting point. But the challenge I'd like to throw out to him is actually, can we have a little bit more spelled out for me where the differences come from for people who are not experts in this area, not necessarily in this hall, but across the board. In my analyst days, I mean, construction industry and long-term construction contracts have some quite degree of similarity with life insurance contracts. There are all sorts of other differences involved. I haven't looked at construction. But we don't see that in any of the accounting literature. And I think the investment community and the actuarial profession would actually help from that. And indeed, the actuarial profession could actually have some input into the accountancy thing. So apologies, Mr. Chairman, but we're short of speakers. But I think that's a very important challenge that we could throw out to the speaker.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a very valid point. And in fact, I think we've not done a particularly good job in the past in getting these messages parceled out to the users so they can understand better. We're starting to improve gradually, but I think we'll obviously do more, and I'm heartened by your encouragement to do more.
Thank you. Would you like to say something, Richard?
Yeah. Does this work? Hello?
Yes?
This is an academic comment, if you will. But the point that was made by Peter Clark, that consistency across different areas of accounting is obviously something that investors, amongst others, would like, because, you know, in your portfolio you've got some I was going to say Cadbury Schweppes shares, you haven't got those anymore, but you know, you've got BP and you've got Aviva and you've got, and how do you weigh up how much you should have of each? So obviously in an ideal world you would want similar information from each type of company, nevertheless reflecting the particularities of its business, so that you can balance your own portfolio. And therefore, the argument was made that, you know, the ISB, in a sense, has a right to say insurers must join in as far as they can with what everybody else does. But I think the question could be asked the other way around, that maybe there are aspects of the way insurers have thought about doing their accounting that would be good lessons for how to do other areas of accounting, given that the underlying model of William Morgan's valuation was that, you know, you need to know about what you think the future cash flows are going to be. And I think he famously said, actually, when he produced the first valuation, and lots of people said, well, what is this nonsense? And he said, I've given you all the assumptions. Or if you don't like the numbers, rework them, as you suggested. And this is quite a powerful thing in the actuarial tradition, which hasn't really been part of the accounting tradition, where there's been a view that, you know, we work out what the best number is and then everybody does that. My colleague Mike Power knows more about this than I do, but I think one could argue that the ISB for a long time had a view that what was going to get consistency was fair value for everybody. And everybody would be driven towards fair valuing everything. And that was even floated, you know, for revenue recognition on long-term contracts at one stage. But they've had to draw back because obviously this is not acceptable to people who are very familiar with other ways of doing things, particularly perhaps in the US. And in a sense, the fallout is in the insurance area, that whereas maybe in 2007 they were moving towards a current exit value which was almost indistinguishable from fair value, now we're back to something which is much more like where they've had to go back to on revenue recognition, that basically you've got to spread the initial cost over the initial consideration over the life of the contract. So that's not a very coherent guide to what to do next, but I think it's just bringing out the fact that the consistency thing is very important. And I think one could argue that for a long time, the boards were kind of pinning their hope that fair value would get the consistency, and now they've had to retreat from that. And that's causing all sorts of unwinding problems in other areas which had been led to think that was the way it was going to go.
Thanks, Richard. Any more comments? John. Thanks. And then there's one over there.
It's John Jenkins again. I can follow up on the comment that Peter Wright made just a moment ago. And up until a few months ago, I was very much of the same view as Peter, that Solvency II and the market consistent based balance sheet would effectively, or was likely effectively, to replace embedded value as supplementary information. I'm not so sure about that now, because the latest developments on Solvency II are introducing some very significant non-economic aspects into that, like how future premiums are treated. I certainly don't want to convert this session into a Solvency II session, but based on where Solvency II is currently going, my view is that supplementary reporting will still remain in some shape or form. And if we do have residual margins for very good reasons within IFRS profit reporting, then somebody will want to know what the present value of the release of those margins is. Solvency II was going to do that for us. I'm not sure it will. So I suspect Peter will still be faced with three sets of numbers to explain to his non-executive, non-actuarial colleagues. Sorry, Peter.
Thanks, John. We have a speaker over there.
I'm not an actuary, I'm an accountant who spent a long time in the life insurance industry, though. It seems to me that this whole transition to the new Phase 2 standard is going to be a long period of everybody having internal education and external education. Compared to the Phase 1 change back in 2005, which was comparatively modest for insurers because it affected most other assets and liabilities rather than the insurance contract liabilities, here this is going to be a pretty fundamental change, and I think there's a danger in the debate about the individual ingredients of the Phase 2 standard that we lose sight of some of the sort of broader aspects of how we communicate this to an external audience. So to take for an example, for UK with profit business, currently that's a statutory transfer basis of profit recognition. Under Phase 2 as it currently stands, we will actually lose that as being the profit recognition basis. We will have the movement on the 10% share of the fund. Completely different way of looking at the numbers. Annuity business, currently there's a profit on inception.
and the comparatively small amounts over subsequent periods. Under the Phase 2 standard, there'll be no profit at inception, but you have an amortisation of a residual margin for which there is currently no formula worked out as to how that will work if the ISB choose to change its proposals. For businesses with guarantees and options, currently under the accounting framework, we have a mixed approach. We have, for some contracts, no guarantee valuation, certainly so for US fixed annuity business. For some contracts, there is a partial valuation under US SOPO 301, and some are required to be fair valued as embedded derivatives. So if we move to a new Phase 2 standard, problem one is getting people used to what that guarantee measurement basis is, and problem two is trying to get some level of consistency as to how it's actually done. On some other types of issues, like contract boundaries, there'll be obviously differences between Solvency II and between the IFRS Phase 2 standard as it currently stands. All of this will create some large educational issue. In terms of disclosure, it seems to me that there is a large amount of reconciliation notes will be required to be issued to an external audience so that people get used to. It's not just a numeric exercise, but people understand the genuine dynamics of voluntary differences between what companies have done from Solvency II, from involuntary differences required by the differences between the two sets of rules. In terms of investor needs, it seems to me that there is perhaps two observations here. One, the life insurance industry under current IFRS has been moving to a sources of earnings style voluntary disclosure. This is to aim towards more the buy side analysts who are not used to insurance as a specific industry, trying to help them as to broadly where do we make our money. That requirement will not disappear, and yet the Phase 2 standard comes at this from more of an embedded value style way of presenting the numbers. For an external buy-side analyst who's used to investing in chemical industry or pharmaceuticals or whatever, it is not so intuitive. We're going to have to work hard to somehow bridge the gap. And finally, I would say on the embedded value reporting, it seems to be if we go towards a Phase 2 standard and we have Solvency 2 at or around the same time, analysts will be crying out for some level of stability, and the call will come, give us your embedded value numbers, whether it's MCEV or EEV, just something I'm used to seeing, and there will also be some requirement for what IFRS Phase 1 numbers will be, at least for some period. Final point of detail I just wanted to mention was that somebody mentioned earlier on about the fact that you might have to use FSA-based rules on the Solvency II basis numbers in a framework before IFRS 2 has come into being. I would just mention that for with-profit funds, there is a memorandum of understanding between the ABI and the major insurers to use the FRS 27 realistic liability basis, which I think people would understand that would move under to be the Solvency II basis. However, FRS 27 also says that you shouldn't recognise the shareholder's share of future accrued bonuses built into that realistic liability. Currently, as the Phase 2 standards are set up, there is a difference of view there, and that would need to be managed. So at some stage, the major insurers and the ABI will need to tackle that problem with the ISB.
On the previous comments on the paper, on whether shareholder and potential shareholder will be better communicated, on what the profession can do, particularly in the light of the last speaker's comments about the need for education around financial statements. Do people think that is an area where the profession could play a role? Perhaps working with the accounting profession? We could just lock the door until somebody speaks. Maybe I could do a show of hands then. Hands up who thinks that the actuarial profession should work more closely with the accounting profession in developing these standards. Well, excellent. That's good. So the accountants in the audience, you've got some people to work with. Hansip, who thinks the actuarial profession has a role to play in communicating these new standards better to boards and other users of this information? Okay, so would one of those people with their hands up, oh, you're all right, put them down there, like to come and talk about how that might happen? Should we be having more exams in communication, more exams on accounting standards? This is like a kind of Mexican standoff, isn't it? Who's going to crack first? Cameron, do you have any questions for the audience?
There's a hand up.
Ah, excellent. Thank you. You'd like to.
Having worked with accountants more closely in the last few years, I definitely think working closer with accountants would benefit both professions. We use very different languages and different vocabularies, and I certainly have learned a lot from accountants, and I hope accountants I work with have learned a lot from me and my colleagues. And I think that the actuarial profession can definitely help users of accounts understand better what the information reported, what's underneath the information. We understand the risks underlying all the cash flows, and we definitely can help users understand better what's there. So whether it's through more communication exams, obviously I'm sure it would work given the prodding we need here to get people to talk, but maybe also a wider understanding of insurance accounting, not just actuarial reserving and, you know, the very technical aspects of our actuarial work, but much more broadly what's happening in the accounting world of insurance would help actuaries.
Thank you.
And hopefully that paper is a start with the summary of all the accounting standards that apply to us.
Definitely. Okay, I'll do one last plea for speakers, and then I will hand over to Francesco to summarise the discussion. So this is your last chance to contribute to this debate. Okay, in which case I'll hand over to Francesco.
Thank you, Catherine, and ladies and gentlemen. It is a great pleasure to be here this evening to talk to you. I believe that what we have heard is indeed the sign that a new era for insurance accounting is about to begin. But would it be a golden age, or one that will make the understanding of insurance profit drivers even more impenetrable than they are today? Call me an incurable optimist. I believe that it will be a positive change for the insurance sector. I am convinced that this new IFRS model will make investors come back with confidence to an industry whose shares used to be in every fund manager's portfolio. Achieving this important change will not be pain-free, and the actuarial profession plays a key role to ensure that this opportunity is converted into reality efficiently. The esteemed colleagues of the Working Party have illustrated with great insight and detail the fundamental planks of the new accounting model and highlighted areas where flaws exist and must be fixed. Let me draw your attention to a couple of features of the new IFRS that would, by themselves, warrant great attention for their potential benefits to the quality of insurance accounting under IFRS. One, the consistency of accounting that the new IFRS will bring, and two, the unprecedented degree of transparency. IFRS today is just a label, covering every possible accounting basis and its contrary. The compromise of the Phase 1 IFRS back in 2005 simply preserved the diversity of accounting basis that characterized the EU insurance sector, but with a misleading IFRS label on top of it. What a life insurer in the UK calls IFRS profit is significantly different from what a French competitor, for example, using the same definition, would be reporting in its financial statements. This lack of comparability will be over for good when the new IFRS is adopted. The real transition to IFRS for the insurance sector was not in 2005. It is the one that comes with the Phase 2 standard. The uniformity of a single accounting regime would in itself be a great benefit for the whole European insurance market. But the drive to transparency would make it even more revolutionary. The presentation of a best estimate with an explicit measure of in-force unexpired risk and the profit yet to be earned would be a fundamental set of disclosures that can explain clearly how money is made in the insurance business. The margin presentation emphasizes these characteristics of the accounting model, translating them in sources of profit that trace back to hard cash information. 2 weeks ago, I participated in a debate on Phase 2 accounting, and a group CFO of a major international insurance business stated, "The model that comes from Phase 2 is more like management reports I use to run the business, and so it is not fit for the purpose of general financial reporting." An investor in the audience approached me at the end of the debate and said to me, "I was not sure if I would report Phase 2, but having heard the CFO statement, well, look what I tell you, I now believe that Phase 2 must be a good thing for the markets." Ladies and gentlemen, the new IFRS is not perfect, but the ISB is working very hard to adjust it, and I'm absolutely confident that the research presented tonight will be a key contribution to its proper completion. With all the necessary improvements, I believe it will deliver what the insurance market has needed for a long while, a consistent, credible, and transparent form of profit reporting that can put the insurance sector on a level playing field with the rest of the market. Thank you.
I'm now going to invite Cameron to respond.
Thank you all for coming. It's been an excellent turnout today. It's great to see such interest in insurance accounting these days. And thanks to all of you who have taken the time to read the paper and provide comments. You've provided extremely useful feedback and demonstrated the value of holding this meeting. In response, I'd like to start with a measurement model. I would portray my views as somewhere between Professor McVie and the incurable optimist, Francesco Nagari. We must not forget what progress we have already made in the insurance contracts project when compared with current practice. Phase 2 insurance accounting will be a big step forward compared with existing IFRS. Nevertheless, the hybrid measurement model as put forward in the exposure draft is untested throughout the world. Thank you to John Jenkins for providing helpful comments on the measurement model as described in the exposure draft. And I would say that the Working Party paper is very aligned with your suggestions on acquisition costs, unlocking the residual margin, and transitional arrangements. And I would expect movement from the IASB on all these issues. I would like to just touch on the thorny subject of own credit risk in the context of the measurement model, and in particular in the context of considering an economic value. We have heard from Tony Silverman and Martin White, they are very clear they do not like the concept of own credit risk coming into accounting. We immediately heard the phrase, and I wrote it down, self-inflicted competitive disadvantage in the context of the insurance industry from Catherine Morgan. I'm sure she was talking about something else. And then we heard from Peter Clark and Rob Seward about the need for consistency of insurance accounting with wider accounting developments. And we must not forget, it is very clear that own credit risk is a concept that is recognised in other accounting standards, in particular financial instrument liabilities and pension scheme accounting. And I think this is an area where we have to be very careful not to be too dogmatic in one direction or the other. There are unintended consequences of no own credit risk that we have seen very recently in the Swiss market following the introduction of the Swiss solvency test this last year end, where we've seen very strange sort of movements in the government bond market and drying up of the medium to long-term government bond market. We saw similar issues at year-end 2008, looking at government bonds to swaps. There are unintended consequences of having zero own credit risk in the accounting and attempting to match those, particularly against any one particular financial instrument. But more widely, the hybrid measurement model will be challenging for investors to understand, and it took them a few years to get comfortable with phase one. And I welcome John Ryan's comments to think about the external users. This desire to consider the prospective investors is fundamental to the IASB's philosophy. Witness the objective of financial reporting set out in the recent draft conceptual framework and quoted in section 2.2.6 of our paper. And this leads to three topics which I believe we must work hard to get right to enter into a new era of positive engagement with investors: the statement of performance, the link with Solvency II, and supplementary reporting. First, the statement of performance. A number of UK and continental European headquartered multinationals already publish supplementary IFRS earnings using something close to the margin analysis approach. This has helped investors better understand the sources of these earnings and improve their forecasting models. But this supplementary information was always intended to complement the premiums and other cash flow information found in current accounting, as well as the embedded value analysis movement, and I do hope such information does not disappear entirely in a phase two world. In the context of the cash flow information, a clear table in the notes would, in my view, be fine. Moving on, it is not at all clear to me how the margin analysis, combined with a phase two measurement model, will allow users to link IFRS earnings with distributable earnings in anything more than an approximate manner. I share Professor McVie and Paul Whitlock's views that it is the regulatory returns more than the primary accounts that drive an insurance company's dividend-paying ability, both currently and in Solvency II. So any link with distributable earnings has to bear in mind the solvency position. This brings us to the link with Solvency II. We have heard a number of speakers discuss this topic in the context of IFRS developments. I agree with John Ryan that Solvency II is in principle about solvency. But the Framework Directive does put forward an economic balance sheet approach to measure the available capital and to stress it to work out required capital. Solvency II does appear to be driving a greater need for transparency about where the prudence lies. But picking up John Jenkins' response to Peter Wright, I agree with John Jenkins that the actual detailed rules and application of Solvency II, particularly in the Quiz 5 specification and the Level 2 work done to date, does appear to be going in a more prudential direction, even in the context of the valuation and measurement of assets and liabilities. And I refer the audience to Section 8.3.5 and Appendix A of the paper, where a number of significant issues are identified with current Quiz 5 developments in the context of a more realistic valuation. So it would be great if IFRS and Solvency II were fully aligned. That is highly unlikely to happen given the different purposes and target audiences, but we could at least try to minimise differences. Alistair Black sees a day where Solvency II may force companies to come up with a different fair value of financial instrument assets than IFRS, mirroring the developments we have seen to date in other areas such as the definition of contract boundary and the measurement of debt liabilities. I agree with his conclusion that we have to develop our Solvency II systems sufficiently flexibly to cope with different IFRS positions. But I do hope that we never get to the position where the two frameworks use different so-called fair values in the measurement of the assets. That would not go down well with investors. Now, I know many of you work in Solvency II projects where you or your colleagues are involved in lobbying on the Level 2 implementing measures. Paragraph 46 of the Solvency II Framework Directive unchanged in the Omnibus 2 Directive, instructs the Solvency 2 standard setters to try and maintain compatibility with international accounting developments to the extent possible. Please feel free to remind your colleagues of this, dear, particularly those of you who have direct contact with the standard setters. And third, supplementary reporting. I am very glad Professor McPhee noted the recent research by George Serafame showing how embedded value reporting reduces information asymmetries. This reminds us of the value of publishing embedded values at a time when it is unfashionable in some quarters to make this point. Insurance companies have become much more transparent in their dealings with investors in recent years, showing investors the information they are using in business planning and day-to-day decision-making, including embedded values and wider cash flow metrics. Noting David Martin's comments, it would seem to me perverse to even consider dropping such information at a time when primary accounts and regulatory returns are undergoing such change. Yes, we should be looking to improve supplementary reporting, in particular in the communication of projected cash flows, as noted by Paul Whitlock and Robert Bumford. But I hope and trust we are planning for evolution and not abandonment. Otherwise, I fear we will disengage and not re-engage with investors. To combine these three topics and enter into a new era of communication with investors, I believe we need a supplementary performance statement presentation which reconciles IFRS earnings and the Solvency II analysis of surplus, showing the analysis of free surplus or free cash flows. Remember, most companies publishing under either the EEV or MCEV principles today show a very useful analysis of free surplus, but this format does not automatically provide a direct link with IFRS earnings. One possible solution to this supplementary reporting challenge was set out in section 2 of the paper, Market Consistent Valuations and Solvency II, Implications of the Recent Financial Crisis, presented here at Staple Inn last September and referenced in our paper. I encourage you to familiarise yourself with this proposal and consider whether it suffices or whether it can be improved. Feel free to get in touch with your thoughts. Going forwards, just to pick up some comments about where how the actual profession goes forwards, just to note a couple of things. The way working parties work means this particular working party will be automatically disbanded after this sessional event and Edinburgh on the 11th of May. But there is a new development, just to bring it all up to speed. There is a new accounting issues group in the process of being formed, which will be cross-practice, which will look at the actuarial profession working closely with international accounting developments and providing feedback to the accounting profession. And I think this will be an excellent tool going forwards to ensure the actuarial profession remains engaged. This is a group which I have recently been asked to lead, and I welcome all your feedback afterwards on some of the ways that we can potentially keep this engagement going forwards and any ideas you may have. And finally, it is refreshing to see the comments provided on the exposure draft make such an impact on the IASB's recent deliberations and tentative decisions. Please keep up the good work, I ask you all. Please continue to provide feedback on developments between now and the finalisation of the standard. I believe that the IASB is listening and that it is worth us going the final mile to make the standard serve us well for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Cameron. So it remains for me to express my own thanks and the thanks of everybody here to the Working Party authors, the opener and the closer, and all those who contributed to the debate in this evening's discussion. I found the paper to be an excellent paper, and I'm very interested in your news about the new member interest group on accounting issues. That's very good news. There's going to be a drinks reception in the council chamber where we can continue the discussion and give Cameron feedback as he requested, and I now declare the meeting closed.